Crowwheel here. Today we review an IPA and discuss Dune versus Lord of the Rings. Hello and welcome to Beer and Conversation with Pigweed and Crowhill. Good evening, Pigweed.
Good evening, Crowhill.
What's on your mind?
Well, I came across this very brief discussion on Dune versus the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
And let me just read the first sentence. It says, Tolkien hated Dune, but was too polite to explain why. When you compare the sensibility of Tolkien's writings to those of Herbert's, it makes sense why it wouldn't appeal to him.
Okay.
And so I thought, you know, you are more familiar with both of these series than I am, that I will kind of read through some of this evaluation by this guy, why he thinks that Tolkien would not have liked it, because, as he says, it's not like Tolkien, you know, wrote an essay on,
right.
Yeah. But why it makes sense that Tolkien would frown on Dune, and get your response.
Yeah, aside from the fact that Tolkien was probably just sort of a curmudgeonly old fart.
What was Dune, 65 or something like that?
Yeah,
Dune?
Yeah. And it was the end of his life.
Yeah.
But Tolkien is well known. He didn't like Lewis's Narnia series. And
uh-huh.
He basically didn't like anything that he didn't do.
Solid ground to stand on.
Yes, well, I mean, it was a genius. So.
All
right, so what kind of a crazy beer have you brought?
All right,
here?
I don't know. Read the title. It's a long
one. So this is from Atlas Brewing, and it's called Giant Flaming Zombie Polar Bear Double IPA.
Okay. Yes. So I saw it in the store and
how could you resist that?
Near DC, and actually the real eye grabber was the $9.99, which might come into play here.
Yes, there might be an explanation for
yes,
that.
There might be.
Yes.
So you met my beer genius.
Yes.
At work. He probably was not exactly what you were expecting, but
No, wasn't what I expected.
6'7" with a Gandalf beard, but
knows a lot about beer.
But he does know a lot about beer. So I mentioned, because it's a DC brewery and he works for a DC brewery.
Yeah.
I said, so you're familiar with Atlas? He told me where it was. I told him I got the double IPA, and he says, He says, yeah. He says, you know, they don't actually move a lot of beer through beer stores.
Yeah.
You might want to check the date on that.
Yeah. And what do you know?
October 30th, 2023.
Yeah, and it's well into 2024 right now. So
the question is, for some beers, I've got beers over here that have been sitting there for 4 years.
Right, and they'll be better.
And they'll be fine. Now,
four more.
A double IPA after 5 months,
right?
Again, might explain the $9.99.
Yes.
Which I wasn't thinking of at the time, but my guy already was way ahead of me. I didn't even tell him the price.
Yeah. So there's a couple things to think about here.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, high alcohol beers age better. And this one is 9.4%.
So
that point of view, it should age well. However, a double IPA generally relies on a lot of hop aroma. So from that point of view,
uh-huh.
Not so much on the aging side, because you lose hop aroma over time when you age something.
It's a hop-forward beer.
Yes.
And so all hops tend to dissipate faster than malt flavor. In fact, malt flavors get better when they blend together.
Yeah, so the hop flavor tends to mellow out, and that's not what you expect in a double IPA. I'm still getting somewhat hop
aroma. I'm getting
aroma
a reasonable amount of hop aroma.
It would be lovely if we had this...
A freshie?
This old one and a freshie to compare. That would be interesting. I would expect that the fresh one would have way more hop-forward aroma. But I haven't even taken a sip yet. So
we got 75 IBUs. Brewed in the district.
I like it. It's got kind of a piney sort of a hop flavor.
It doesn't say what hops are used, but I would tend towards the piney than the not.
Yeah, the piney sticky kind of hop flavor, and it's got a good maltiness to it. It's got a really good hop bitterness.
Well, I'm getting
You getting an odd flavor?
On the back end.
Like, there is something.
There is something. But again, without having a fresh one on hand,
yes.
You're like, I mean, is that just how the beer is?
Yeah, because there
or
are
Or is it a consequence of the 5 months?
Exactly, because there are some hops that give kind of a funky sort of a flavor, and that's I'm getting a little bit of that. You're right. After the swallow, after
you kind of wait a little bit, you're like, what's that lingering flavor?
You get this lingering, slightly funky kind of a flavor.
I don't know if that's I'm sure my guy would know that. That's oxidation or whatever.
I don't think it's oxidation, but yeah, so that would be interesting. I mean, we need to find both a fresh one and an old one, and.
That's the Northeast DC. Maybe we've got ourselves a field trip.
There we go. Yeah. What we need to do is buy one, stick it up there with your other beers and let it sit for a while, and then buy a fresh one and see what happens. All right. So Tolkien and... Now, I know some people say Tolkien. I just say Tolkien. So I... Sorry.
Yeah.
JRR, if you're offended, but that's just what I say.
I know you're not a South Park fan. So... For as long as I can remember, the show's been on 20 years now.
Yeah,
it's in a small town in Colorado, mm-hmm. and there's only one black kid.
Okay,
and his name is Token. Until recently,
awful. Yeah,
and recently he's like, my name is Token. What? And everybody, so they've been doing this for 20 years before they decided it, before they all figured it out. They're like, oh. Oh, sorry about that. You thought my name was Token? He's a huge Lord of the Rings. His dad is like this huge Lord of the Rings fan.
Right. So, oh, my gosh.
Oh, but, obviously they couldn't. They meant for it to be harsh.
Yeah.
And then just later on decided, I got a zinger for you. What if we say, that's funny though, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not Token. It's not, maybe Tolkien.
Maybe Tolkien, but we'll just say like Tolkien. Yeah.
So I'm going to go with this one, this first one here, and your reaction.
Okay.
The Lord of the Rings has clearly defined good guys and bad guys and is a story of good triumphing over evil, while Dune is a group of not-so-good people getting revenge on even worse people.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Is that fair? Okay.
Tolkien, a lot of people criticize The Lord of the Rings for the characters being too monodimensional. You have the good guys and you have the bad guys. And I think that's a little harsh because there are difficult characters in The Lord of the Rings. You have Saruman who becomes evil, and you have Boromir who gets tempted by the ring and becomes evil. And even in the good characters, you have flashes of temper and other kinds. So I don't think the characters are quite as monochromatic as people like to make it. However,
is Gollum a bad guy?
Yes, but he didn't start off as one.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, he ends up having a complicated, when Frodo and Sam meet up with Gollum in the Dead Marshes, and they end up taming him, you see this complicated thing going on in Gollum. You can see the tension in Gollum between the good Gollum and the Sméagol character, mm-hmm. and the Gollum character. And so that's a good example, mm-hmm. of that there is some moral depth and stuff going on. However, it is true that Tolkien is writing about a moral universe. He was a devout Catholic, and he wanted to have good and evil in a clearer way. And Herbert apparently was agnostic or not religious and did not create this moral universe. Everything was more, mm-hmm. focused around trade-offs. And it's almost like one of the big themes in Dune is ecology, but not just ecology in the sense of the environment, but ecology in the sense of this thing has this consequence and this thing has this other consequence, and balancing the consequences.
Okay.
So it's not a clear moral universe the way The Lord of the Rings is. It's more of a bunch of balancing acts.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a good criticism.
How about this one? Lord of the Rings has themes lifted from Judeo-Christian theology and heroes rising up to fulfill their destinies.
Mm-hmm.
Dune is very much an anti-religious story about the weaponization of faith and man-made prophets claiming destiny as justification for their grasps at power.
Yeah, so
it's not too bad.
No, that's pretty good. And the Lord of the Rings was written to create a mythology for England. I read one time that Tolkien was upset that, you know, Greece has a mythology and Rome has a mythology, but where is England's mythology?
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted to create one, but he also wanted to create a world for the languages that he was creating.
King Arthur is a bit of English mythology.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So he wanted to create a mythology for England, but he also wanted to create a backdrop for these languages, because he was first and foremost a philologist, somebody who studied language, and he created Elvish and, you know, these other languages, and he wanted to create a world, because you can't have a language without a world that it lives in. It doesn't make much sense.
Right.
So he started with the language and then created the world to go along with the language, which is interesting.
Yeah, fascinating.
So yes, he was. It's much more mythological. It's much more focused around language and culture, and it's
and so the Bene Gesserit are fascinating.
They are very fascinating,
and it's brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
In that it's a declaration of the identifying the necessity of religion for a culture to thrive, and yet a little bit of cynicism in that they don't actually believe this, and so I think this the weaponization of faith.
Yes.
But not for their own selfish ends, I don't think. I think that they believe that the proper use, they wouldn't call it the weaponization of faith. They're going, the proper use of the need for faith can be used in a positive way to benefit mankind, something along those lines.
It's very complicated, and it's fascinating. And one of the things that's common between Tolkien and Herbert is they create these deep worlds. There's all these other things going on,
right.
You know, layers and layers and things within there's a phrase in Dune that's not occurring to me, but it's like things inside of things inside of things,
right?
And the Bene Gesserit are fascinating because they're almost like a religious order of nuns in a way.
I've heard them referred to as, you know, space witches. You know, there's something a little slightly witchy about them.
But at the same time, they are atheists, and they use religion to manipulate. They don't believe it, but they use it to. So the whole thing in Dune, you know, when Paul and Jessica go to Dune, and it turns out that there's already this mythology on Dune of the Lisan al-Ghaib, the prophet who's going to come and change everything. Well, that was something that was planted there by the Bene Gesserit centuries before.
Yes.
So it is this whole, pardon me, this
idea. But they believe it, but they are also trying to actually make it true. It's not just that they're going to leave the mythology in place for its own sake. They actually believe that this person will come true, but not through some divine intervention, but through their intervention. They're going to, in some way, genetically manufacture a great savior.
Yes. So
it's fascinating.
It is fascinating, and it's thousands of years in development, which is another fascinating part about it. So they had this vision, which doesn't really get explained until one of the later books written by Herbert's son. But,
that far down?
Yeah. So I mean, it's hinted at different places, but it's explained much better in some of the later books. But the idea is that thousands of years before any of the events in Dune, the Bene Gesserit had this idea of creating the perfect man to be sort of the savior of mankind and the ultimate leader. But by
an all female cult or whatever.
But under their control also.
Yeah.
So they had this vision of saving/controlling humanity by creating this the Kwisatz Haderach. And what they would do is they would blend different bloodlines. And the way they would do that is they would get impregnated. They're all women. They would get impregnated by different people and guide this genetic line to this ultimate person. Right. And that's, Dune is the end of that process, where they're like within a generation of, or two, of getting the Kwisatz Haderach. And
so this is what, why Paul, how Paul finds out that he's actually a
Harkonnen.
Yeah,
that's right. Yes, because he's
right. Been, because his identity is 100%
Atreides.
Atreides.
Yeah.
Yes.
And Atreides and Harkonnens are blood feud enemies.
Right. Exactly.
And then he finds out that it's just so much. It is so much.
And this is only book one.
Yes. And Jessica was only supposed to have female children.
Right.
But the Bene Gesserit are so amazing that they can manipulate their body so that they can decide whether to have a male or a female child.
Right. Yeah. Which you told me that the reason that that Baron Harkonnen is so fat and disgusting,
mm-hmm.
Because in the kind of shaky 80s version,
mm-hmm.
he was disgusting and diseased.
Yes.
Where in this one, he's very smooth-skinned, just enormously fat. And I remember mentioning to my, you know, kids, my grandkids, who I took to the movie, you know, he's just a big fat slob.
Mm-hmm.
But
he wasn't that way originally. He was actually a very powerfully built, athletic man.
Oh, okay.
But he was a creep. The Harkonnens are not good people.
Right.
And the Bene Gesserit wanted his DNA for their thing, right? So one of the Bene Gesserit leaders went to get impregnated by Vladimir Harkonnen, and he pulled a trick on her and basically raped her. And So she pulled a trick on him and manipulated her body chemistry to infect him with this nasty bug, which made him big and fat. And the reason he floats around in the air is because he doesn't have the muscle strength to stand up and walk. So he has to wear these suspensor belts.
But it's not just because of his girth. His legs have...
Yeah, he just can't walk around.
All right, hold on. I'm sort of getting Tolkien short shrift here.
Okay, yeah.
How about this? Lord of the Rings is about small people from humble backgrounds facing dangers to protect what they love.
Mm-hmm.
Dune is about aristocrats killing aristocrats and using the little people as cannon fodder.
Yes, that is very true.
That's not too bad.
And that goes back
to... So this is something I'm sure that Tolkien would take pride in pointing out.
Yeah.
And saying why yours... Dune sucks. And
so Tolkien was in World War One.
Okay, I got that down here too.
Yeah.
Yes.
So he
let's don't forget that
he kind of hated the mechanistic warfare. You know, he in the back of his mind is knights on horses and this kind of glamorous, probably false, but idea of kind of a noble warfare. And here we have this technology.
Once you've seen trench warfare, it probably doesn't seem very sexy.
No, it's just technology mowing people down,
right,
and killing thousands and thousands of people with machines. And that, so to him, you have these patterns in The Lord of the Rings, like the miller in Hobbiton he's not the good guy because he's bringing technology into this idyllic situation. Tolkien grew up in a farm life where things were very agricultural and idyllic and all this, and the idea of people bringing in tractors and machines and all this kind of stuff, he didn't like that. So there is a lot in The Lord of the Rings about simple, quiet people, mm-hmm. you know, who live on the land. And
right. And this something else that I noticed, the simple, quiet, sitting back and having a nice meal and your mm-hmm. second breakfast and a pipe, is that simple enjoyment in life. There's none of that in Dune. I don't see any mirth. I don't see any joy. I don't see like people enjoying a delicious meal and back slapping and like there was like one joke.
Yeah.
Where people. And in Lord of the Rings,
yeah.
you get plenty of the enjoyment of simple pleasures and food. And
I think that's a great observation, because one of the big themes in The Lord of the Rings is taking joy in simple things in life.
Yeah.
Things that are just normal things like stars and trees
yeah.
and brooks and, you know, a mug of beer.
Getting back to the, where's the Hobbit from? The Shire.
Yeah.
Getting back to the Shire yeah. where you know everybody and, you yes. know, the joy of all that.
Somebody,
I'm not kidding.
People loving gardens, you know. That's, yeah.
So, every, in Dune is just... Everything is just hanging on the edge of survival.
Yes, well, it's this ecology thing. You're right. It's everything is on the edge, and it's balancing this thing against that thing. And there's no joy in the simple things in life in Dune. Everything is conflict and...
It's
now, it's fascinating. I love it. I love the books. But it's a very different view of the world.
How about the... The Lord of the Rings is optimistic and ends with a true king being restored to the throne and ushering in a golden age. Dune is pessimistic and ends with a tyrant being replaced by another tyrant.
Yes, very true. And there's no vision of... So Paul, one of the big things about Dune is people typically think of Paul as the hero. He's not really the hero.
I know, the viewer... is wanting a hero.
Yeah.
And so you're kind of imposing that on Paul.
Yeah.
And Paul disappoints.
Yes. So Paul has been forced into this situation by various things. One thing was his family raised him to be a mentat. So part of the background to Dune.
This is great. Go.
Yes. Part of the background to Dune is they rebelled against the thinking machines. And they said, from now on, you can't make a thinking machine. You can have technology, but it can't be thinking technology. And you have to train people to do... So they would have these people called mentats who would do calculations in their heads.
Right.
So Paul was a combination of being in a royal house. He was going to be a duke. He was also a mentat.
Hmm.
But unbeknownst to his father, he was also in this Bene Gesserit line of succession towards this ultimate Cresac Haderach character. Right.
But I mean, he had to have known. I mean, he knew that his wife was a Bene Gesserit.
Yes, yes. So he knew he was, but to some extent, being used. Duke Leto, Paul's father. So Paul is, yes, he's nobility, and he's forced into this situation, but he's not. He's not trying to save the world. He's like, I'm forced into this place where I have to avenge my father. I have to, you know, kill the Harkonnens. I have to establish my household. And he does all the things that he does because he gets this prescience from the spice, which is, you know, inherent in Dune. There's a lot of spice on the planet. And the spice changes his mind.
Is it the only place that there's spice?
Yeah. Until later. But yes, it's the only place where there's spice because it comes from the worms on Dune. And he gets this prescience, and he sees these futures, and he's trying to, like, negotiate his way through these possible futures. But it's not about, you know, the wonderful person trying to save the universe. He's just kind of stuck in this, with these bad choices, trying to find the least bad choice of what he's...
Yes. And so I would say that there's not... That if you're a Lord of the Ringer criticizing the Dooners for not stacking up and the things that we've talked about, that's not you can like one more than the other, mm-hmm. but it's a fascinating alternative view and a different mindset and a different, but it doesn't make it wrong.
Yeah.
Is what I mean. You know what I mean?
The depth of both of the books is phenomenal.
Yeah.
And the vision and the way that it's not just a story about, you know, guy meeting girl, falls in love, shoots somebody. It's this world changing panoramic view of
humanity. I think we're going to get the Duneverse here soon, right? I mean, I'm sure because if they decide we're just going to do Dune 1 mm-hmm. in two movies,
yeah.
then it would have been easy to end it with everybody in the galaxy bending the knee to the idea that we have a new emperor and, you know,
And they didn't.
The
do
scene
that.
Is over. Right. The yeah. scene is over, and they didn't do the book. Didn't do that, yeah. and the movie didn't do that, mm-hmm. which means it ain't over
there's
yet.
There's plenty of other books. There's lots of other books. Yeah.
So how many did he write before the son picked up on the?
Yeah, I think five. I think Herbert wrote five, and then his son, along with another guy, who was a famous science fiction author, wrote, I don't know, seven or eight or nine, a whole bunch more. And I read all the Frank Herbert books, and I've read several, five or six of the ones by his son, and they're really good. And they're really fascinating, and I just love the whole Dune universe. The depth of it and the intrigue and all the things going on and the way it creates technology without technology.
Exactly. Well, that's just what I wrote down because I wanted to get back to the Mentat. Mm-hmm. It's the idea that they you brought this up last week about how quickly we are running into an AI world, mm-hmm. and Herbert had already anticipated.
In 1965,
that we will get an AI world, and it will have disastrous results, and then we'll come out on the other side and go, yes. All right, we're not doing that anymore.
Yes,
right. Isn't this a post AI world?
Exactly, and that
before there was AI, which is what's so fascinating.
Yes, and that ties in a way with what I was saying before about Herbert. Everything's ecology. It's action and reaction. It's this thing and this thing combating against it and this thing combating against it. And there's never any solution. It's not a symphony where you build to a grand finale and it's done. It's more like a fugue where everything is going back and forth, you know, arguing back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And there's no resolution. There's never supposed to be a resolution.
Right. Which is what gives them, it's the post-AI rehumanism of it that makes it both futuristic and old school at the same time.
Exactly.
There's this old Roman Empire feel to it in the future.
Yes. And that's fantastic. And that's one of the things that's similar between them is they both have this sort of medieval feel.
Yeah.
In weird ways.
Yes. Because Middle Earth doesn't even have a time.
Yes.
And this is, was it 10,000 years in the future?
It's way, way, way in the future, but it still has some a medieval kind of a feel to it. But there's knights fighting with swords. But there's
isn't it because the reason that they fight with swords is because their body shields, right? So they have this shield that will deflect firing weapons, therefore it forces them to actually fight hand-to-hand combat.
Yes, so it's more complicated than that, but yes, that's right. Okay. So they have these personal shields that they wear, and apparently if you fire a las gun, which is the kinds of weapons they would use, and you shoot a las gun at a shield, it makes like a nuclear explosion, so you don't do that.
Okay.
So the what you do instead is you have projectile weapons that are slow, or you fight with knives.
Right.
And sometimes it's the slow knife that gets through the shield that kills. So it's and it's this very, that's another thing about Herbert's world.
That's brilliant because how else could you explain why is it?
Why don't they just shoot them?
Yes. you could travel across time, but you can't just have a blast that kills everybody all at once.
Yeah.
No?
There's a reason. There's a reason.
It's been thought through.
He's a smart guy, and he thought through it all. So there's the medieval feel. There's knights. There's castles in both. There's great houses.
Yeah. There's no talk of democracy.
Yes.
You're right. I mean, it's feudal. Right.
It's feudal. There's wizard-like characters.
Right.
To some extent, the hero journey plays in both stories. Mm-hmm. There's kind of a... To some extent, there's a feel of transcendence, although I would say that's much stronger in Tolkien than in Dune. But there's this idea of grand things going on, you know, way bigger than the individual characters. The hero is not acting for himself, but for others to some extent, although that's not quite as true in Dune.
Right.
And then there's this, as I mentioned before, this immense world building. It's not just a murder that takes place in a house or in a neighborhood.
Right.
It's
this, right. Now, one guy saving his own skin.
Yes.
It's, broader
it's
themes.
Just immense in what they did. Yeah, but there's also a lot of differences between them. I think Dune is about the future and and Tolkien's stuff is about the past, in a way.
Nostalgia.
Yeah, nostalgia, uh-huh. Right. So Dune is sort of forward-looking, and Tolkien's more nostalgia. Dune is more technological, and in Tolkien's world, the technology is what the bad guys do.
The bombs.
Yeah, right. So Saruman is the one who has the blasting thing, the things that are like explosives.
Yes, like I was wondering about that, like technologically. So I didn't realize that there was, you know, during the big battle, you've got cannonballs or you got explosives.
Yeah.
But the explosives are primarily used by the bad guys?
Yes. Yeah, the good guys don't do any of that kind of stuff. The good guys are on their horses, you know, charging in and
trees,
all
and
that kind of stuff. So there's the mythological versus the speculative. Another big difference, as you already pointed out, is the religious difference.
Yeah.
The Tolkien, there is no religion in The Lord of the Rings. There's nothing that's explicitly religious.
All right.
But it's almost like...
Right. It's almost like prayer. There's no appeal to greater.
Well, there is sort of. There's an appeal to Elbereth Gilthoniel, who's, you know, this magical elf, basically. And so there's sort of something like prayer. Mm. And there's things like sacraments. There are objects that carry grace with them.
But as a deeply religious Catholic, you don't feel that he's infusing the whole world with
they're not going to mass on Sundays or anything.
Or some Middle Earth version of not really right.
In one way it's deeply religious, and in one way it's not religious at all. So which is kind of interesting,
which makes it great.
And then so unique to Herbert, I would say, is that religion can be corrupted and used towards political ends. Another thing that's unique to Herbert is the use of psychedelics, because the spice is basically a psychedelic. True. And then the whole idea of ecology and environmentalism and the revival of Arrakis.
Drinking your own sweat and urine.
It's pretty gross, yeah. And then unique to Tolkien, I think, would be the sacramentalism, the idea that... So when Galadriel gives Frodo a gift, when Frodo is leaving Lorien, she gives him... the water from her mirror in a little vial that he takes with him, that becomes a light that becomes brighter in darker places.
It's almost
it's like a sacramental sort of a thing. There's more of a concept of temptation in Tolkien. In Dune, it's more just sort of calculations and being tough. It's not temptation in the same sense that you have in Tolkien. And then I would say there's more of a sense of fall, redemption, and free will in Tolkien, and there's more, it's a more positive, hopeful view.
Yeah. Well, I think that's very interesting. Just two great worlds, and I think we've been fortunate to have two great directors be able to take that world and make great films out of them. It'd be easy to mess this up, but I think they both did a great job, providing very different worldviews.
Very different, and a lot to think about. And just, it's fascinating because I love both of them, and in some ways they're just so very different.
Yes, you're almost. I was wondering if you or this outline I was reading took sides, like, you know, if this is versus this, and you have to either be on Team LOTR or Team Dune,
right?
Or because we're not going to be friends if you pick the wrong side.
Right.
But there's no need to do any of that.
No, I don't think so. Right. I find them both fascinating, and I love them both. And I've read Lord of the Rings many times, and I've read tons of the Dune books.
Right, fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, that's very, very good. Okay, that was fun.
Yeah.
Do you have one more thing you want to discuss before we go?
Yeah, we need a man of the week.
Okay, so this is unrelated to the Stuart.
Totally unrelated to Dune versus Lord.
Okay,
of the Rings.
Yes. You know what? It's funny. The only people who have earned multiple mans of the week have been liberals. I've given Bill Maher. I think Bill Maher might be a three-peat.
Might be.
And here, I think...
Carville, this is at least two.
This is at least
two for Carville.
For Carville. So this is James Carville, who was instrumental in the Bill Clinton presidency and yeah. been a...
it's the economy, stupid. He was the guy behind that.
Oh, is that
him? Yeah,
okay.
I think so.
And he has been, you know, political commentator, operative,
the
whatever.
Raging Cajun.
The Raging Cajun, yeah. Yes. He's great to Cajun Louisiana accent.
Yeah.
And with... is he still married to Mary?
Mary Madeline. So these two.
How
total
did you?
Opposites.
How do you live? Right.
How does that happen?
Who is the same person
on the other side?
On the other side.
They
can you
have
imagine
to.
That
they
house?
Have to. They have to park. It's kind of like the cartoon. Remember the cartoon where there's the sheepdog and there's the wolf,
and they
punch in and they're enemies all day, and then they punch out and they're yeah, good to see you, Frank, and see you tomorrow, Tom.
The only way that could work.
Yes. It had to be something.
So
like that.
What's this? So the latest Carvel, he's been catching some heat from this one for
okay.
the last couple of days.
Yeah,
he Carvel said there are too many preachy females in the
Democratic
the
Party.
Democratic Party. He says a suspicion of mine is that there are too many preachy females. Quote. Don't drink beer. Don't watch football. Don't eat hamburgers. This is not good for you, he said. The message is too feminine. Quote, everything you're doing is destroying the planet. You've got to eat your peas. And so what he's saying is that, you know, you don't want your party to be the party of
the nag.
Of nags and soy boys.
Yes. And that's what
weak
they are.
Sissy men. And bitchy women.
Right.
Well, you know, you got to work on this. Well, they didn't like that. So what were you saying about the Democratic men?
Yeah.
Previously?
So if you think about it, the way the Democratic Party used to be, the party of the guy who went to work all day,
mm-hmm.
the guy who showered when he came home from work, the guy
calloused hands,
carrying his lunch pail, going and working a union job, that was the Democratic Party.
Coming out of a coal mine. And
yeah, and the Republicans were the effete business guys, the
yeah,
Rockefeller Republicans.
Yeah, and their suits and their manicures.
Yes.
And now he's like, we can't have the Democrat Party being the party of overbearing women and soy boys.
And that's what it is.
And that's, yeah.
It's,
you
it's
want that? So now...
College-educated sissy boys who can't live because somebody disagrees with them.
Right, you know? And so if you have young men who are not really politically motivated yet,
yeah. Yeah.
but you have defined your party as the wimpy man party,
yeah.
and they don't really, you know, they haven't really worked it all out. That you, well, yeah. who am I going to be associated with? I guess
yeah.
I'll be over here with the tough Republican guys.
And here's the weird thing about it.
Carvel's totally right, but of course, he's
you
taking
can't say
heat for that.
You can't say preachy female.
you can't
bossy
ladies.
I know, you can't say it. The weird thing, though, is that Donald Trump is a rich guy.
How a billionaire from Queens
yeah.
became...
Because he's been working with construction guys for yeah. decades.
He'll be doing dissertations on this for 50
yeah.
years.
He knows what the common man, what the workman, he knows how they talk. He knows what their priorities
how
are.
How in the world an Ivy League guy who's never been seen not wearing a suit
yeah.
from New York has become the darling of the working class?
Isn't
well,
amazing?
You know what? That's on you,
yeah.
guys. And you guys, and Carvel has nailed it.
Yeah,
we have lost the man, the manly man.
Yeah.
to this guy.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Too many preachy females.
And that's why RFK is going to be pulling some people away from the Democrats, because RFK is whatever else he is, he's a manly man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay,
well, Carvel, James, well done.
You might be surprised to be a twice-time PNC.
I know, man of the week. Well done.
But I hope he doesn't succeed.
Yes. Thanks so much for listening to Beer and Conversation with Pigweed and Crowhill. Remember to visit us at pigweedandcrowhill.com or send us an email at pigweedshow@gmail.com.